for October 16th, 2018, for the Springfield Planning Commission. Just one item on the agenda today, which is discussion of land use decision-making for planning commissioners, elected officials, and planners from Patrick Wingard of the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
It's a mouthful.
Willamette Valley Regional Representative. First of all, let's go ahead and go around the table and introduce ourselves. I'll start on my left with Commissioner Bergen.
My name's Grace Bergen. I have been with Planning Commission since this spring.
Andy Landon, and I finished term and brought me back.
I'm Curry Gill. I just got appointed, so this is my first.
Congratulations.
Tim Bose, in my second term now.
Sophie McGinley, I'm also newly appointed.
Troy Sherwood, I've got 2 years and change on the Planning Commission.
And Mike Cuevilla, my first term is going to be up in February, so I've been on for 3 years.
Great.
If you care to start.
You bet. Well, I wanted to just take a moment and kind of share with you how I got here and a little bit of my background that definitely relates well to Springfield. Been with the department for 6 years. I spent the last year in the valley moving from Astoria. I've got two children and they're both born in the North Coast. Lived up there for 18 years and was the planning director for the city of Warrenton, about population 5,000. Planning manager for Clatsop County, about a 40,000 population county. And started a consulting business, did work for the city of Astoria, the county, Department of Geology, and the LCD came looking for me because I had a pretty good track record. I've worked in some pretty difficult circumstances, was able to, just like you all have, push through some solid plans, long-range plans. Like Glenwood's a great example of, you know, you all sticking your guns and having a plan and now seeing it implemented is beautiful. I'm a Springfield resident. My wife and I, we bought a house up in North Springfield and we're thrilled. So I'm a prospective planning commissioner. Prospective city official. At some point, I'll look to get involved in some of the activities here at the city. Up on the North Coast, I was an elected official. I was a trustee with Clatsop Community College for a couple of terms, and also was president of a local swim club, and just kind of enjoy doing all the things that dads enjoy doing. I think what attracted me to Oregon, I'm originally from Michigan, was the planning program. I have a civil engineering degree, so I just kind of got lucky. I was working for the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, in Southern Oregon. I came out here after I graduated in the mid-90s, and didn't really know what I was doing, and decided that I was going to become a professional land surveyor, and decided when I saw an advertisement for a city planning job in Myrtle Creek that I would apply for it. Not really thinking I would get it, but I did. And so that was almost 20 years ago, so I began my planning career pretty close to here in Douglas County, City of Myrtle Creek, and then was kind of headhunted up to the North Coast, spent 18 years, and now really happy to be back. My family's all back east, but my wife has family here in Eugene, Springfield, and in Roseburg, and again, we're thrilled to be Springfield residents, and really happy to be invited to be here. Any questions or anything else you want to know about me? I'm a duck fan, beaver fan. Right down the middle. But I'm really happy about the ducks win. Should we get started? Okay. So I thought we'd kind of start with just a little bit of history. So zoning in Oregon goes back about 100 years. So we've been at this for about a century. And we're still trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And one of the great things about planning, and I'll probably say it a couple of times tonight, planning commissioners are my favorite people because I know you all get paid really well. And hopefully, you know, when you re-up, you get a raise. But, you know, you all do, and I mean, speaking from the heart as a resident, I mean, we rely on you all to sometimes make really difficult, sometimes painful decisions, but they're consistent with the plan, or the criteria hasn't been met, or, I guess what I'm trying to say is, you all kind of work undercover, you know, you're not in the spotlight until you're in the spotlight, and then everything's on the line, seemingly. You know, you're going to make a decision that's going to ruin the river, or you're going to make a decision that's going to be a detriment to the local economy, or, you know, on and on. So you all, I mean, you have a huge responsibility, and I will, typically through your staff, always be here for you. I think one of the ways that I find my way with the department is always remembering, because I've been a planning director, I've been a consultant, I've kind of been on all sides of the counter, if you will, that I work for you. You know, I advocate. My job is to go to Salem and advocate for you, like your darn UGB order that is stuck at the Department of Justice. You know, to continue to remind the management team, the director's office, whether it's Springfield or Corvallis or Philomath or SIO, where my region lies, I work for you. So it's my job to understand your plans, to get to know you all, to build trust, and hopefully we'll get a little bit of that tonight. So about 30 years after 1919, counties got into the game and began to zone things. I think the planning program really started to become elevated when the state established exclusive farm use zoning in 1963, and then about 10 years later, adopted what is often held up as the standard for a statewide planning program, not only in the U.S., but across the world. Ironically, we seem to get beat up from the inside quite a bit about our land use program, and we're lauded from a lot of people from outside the area, but I think that's just human nature. So when the legislature passed Senate Bill 100, our commission was established a couple of years, or at the same time, I guess, and our commission, Land Conservation Development Commission, was charged with establishing the first set of statewide planning goals. So the first 14 goals encompass transportation, urbanization, natural resources, things of that nature. Goal 15, the Willamette Greenway, came in a little later, and then four coastal goals, goals 16 through 19, which you don't have to deal with, but if you would like to know about them, please ask me. It's not that I ran away from the coast to come to the valley, but I appreciate not having to deal with all the estuary and LNG terminal challenges that we have on the coast. Not to say that the valley doesn't have its own set of challenges and opportunities. So from effectively 1976 to 1986, the Land Conservation Development Commission, our commission, acknowledged all city and county comprehensive plans. As part of that legislation, all cities and counties were required to adopt comprehensive plans that implemented were consistent with the statewide planning goals. So we had some money in that time period. We don't have nearly that same amount of money today that we did when we were helping cities and counties adopt their plans. And I'll kind of touch on that as we get through a little bit more of the history and then the relationship between the state and you all. So subsequent to 86, you'll see here the city went through a number of periodic review updates to your metro plan, which was adopted in 82 in concert with City of Eugene. I'm sure you all are familiar with that element of your comprehensive plan. It's a bit unique. In 2007, the legislature, and I don't really know exactly why, people jokingly, I don't want to offend anybody, refer to this legislation as the divorce, the bifurcation of the UGBs, and the separation. Maybe you can fill me in sometime about sort of what drove that, because I really don't know why that happened, other than, you know, Eugene has its set of goals and policies, and Springfield has its, and perhaps they weren't in line with one another. So with that legislation, similar to 1973, came with a mandate that each city, Eugene and Springfield, adopt its own comprehensive plan. And you all have done some amazing work. You and Eugene have done some great work to establish your urban growth boundaries premised upon all this, the statewide planning goals and what we're trying to accomplish here in Oregon, which is be efficient, be organized, optimize development and conservation lands within urban growth boundaries to relieve pressure on our natural resource lands. You know, we're not a wealthy state, but we do really well by protecting farmland so we can have our crops and our value-added products close to our urban centers. We've done an amazing job not allowing homes and other incompatible development to sprawl up into the hillside so that we can have intensive timber operations. Now, I mean, it cuts both ways, but the fact is, Oregon is the number one lumber producing state in the nation, and Lane County, Douglas County, I mean, knock it off the charts as far as how we employ folks in that sector. So it's important that the land use program work in conjunction with our natural resources, our local economies, and our regional economies.
Question?
Yeah, of course.
Are we still, because I know the state has been a lot of radical cutback, or are we still in the work?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure we are.
Happy.
99% sure. As about a year ago, when I did a presentation somewhere, I researched it and by board feet. It was on the North Coast. So I'm certain that Oregon is still the number one state. I don't know where Lane County fits in, because Lane and Douglas seem to go one and two as far as amount of board feet produced. But yes, just like our fisheries on the coast, there is an impression that those industries, and they're not as robust as they had been in the past, but they're still significant operations in the state of Oregon, both forestry and fisheries. But I think if you did do it compared to years ago, I'm sure it has slipped. So, well, one, the trees aren't as big, so we're not able to get at them like we have in the past. I mentioned here at the last bullet point that our attorneys are still working on your UGB final order, and you know, I hope it's out soon, if there's anything else. So any questions about the history? I probably won't do that pretty fast, but.
That's our latest UGB
thing.
That was 16 that we put that in.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was looking at my phone.
Yeah, you did, in December 16, and then we went through our process, wrapped that up in early 18, and we're still at it. I know our attorneys would say that they absolutely want to get it right. It's really important to us that we build based upon your counsel's decision, based upon the record, that we don't screw anything up. We're, I think, being very meticulous about the order. So I want to talk a little bit about state and local responsibilities. Just first about the state, Department of Land Conservation Development, so we're the state's land use agency, and it's our responsibility in concert with our commission, and of course in collaboration with local governments and stakeholders, to set land use policy, the statewide planning goals, the statutes and the administrative rules that implement the goals. It's our job to acknowledge city and county plans. So acknowledge is, I guess, our fancy word for approve. But acknowledge has a definition in statute that's important. If a local government adopts a plan or an ordinance, does not provide us notice, does not provide opportunity for the department to participate in that process, does not provide us the final decision document, even though it's approved locally, if that decision were appealed to Land Use Board of Appeals, LUBA, they couldn't use that non-acknowledged plan. So I don't think you guys have any loose strings.
Other than what we're waiting on.
Right, right. That was a big one. But as far as plan amendments, there are several cities and counties more familiar with the North Coast, because I was there a long time, that for whatever reason never got some of their plans acknowledged. And it's not a big deal until it becomes a big deal and on appeal. Clatsop County had to deal with this, where they had to make findings against two sets of ordinances because they weren't really sure which one was the right one. And so that's where the acknowledgement part comes in. Important. So our job to enforce the goals that effectively is through a process that we trigger our reviews on plan amendments. We affectionately call them PAPAs, post-acknowledgement plan amendment. So the post-acknowledgement is anything that happened after your comprehensive plan was acknowledged, I think in 1982, if I remember the slide, and any decisions subsequent to that amended the plan. The periodic review requirement here, the fifth bullet, probably deserves a little bit of conversation. So in statute and largely Oregon's planning program, when it originated, was premised on the department having fairly significant grant program that we would pass through to local governments to ensure that your comprehensive plans, which I'm sure at that point were like the most complex in the nation, could be updated, which is necessary as values change and economic opportunities change and the needs of each of our communities change. We want the plans to stay up to date. That's a real challenge for us. The periodic review program, even though it came with it a large amount of money, it also came with it a ton of requirements. I was brought up to the North Coast because the city of Warrenton was in a heapload of trouble with our commission by basically ignoring mandates to get a transportation plan done, to protect wetlands adequately, to get a estuary plan in place. And we were getting fined. Effectively, they took our ability to plan for ourselves away. They shut down all zone changes on 101, all significant development plans, and forced the city to come to Salem and work to get this periodic review program complete. So that was great. The periodic review work is done, but it leaves a lot of heartburn and bad feelings between the state and cities and counties. Long story short, periodic review sort of ran its course. Cities can still opt in to periodic review. I think the Dalles were the last city to do that 3 or 4 years ago. You're still met with the same requirements and statute that have always been there to have a very rigorous, detailed work program that your council adopts, our commission adopts, then you get to work. The challenge is you need money to get that work done. Sandy and Mark and your staff can't do it all, right? And we have some money. The legislature came through with us for some housing money, and I think the legislature recognizes that cities and counties in Oregon, for us to be successful, we really need our plans to stay updated. So that periodic review requirement, more to come. I think we're going to see some rulemaking on that this session, and we can be updated, and we'll see. I'm hoping that we can just kind of take what we did under periodic review, make it more of a voluntary program, and then provide the funding and the technical and other resources to get that work done another way with the same outcome, or a better outcome, I guess. And then lastly, it's our job. That's why you have a field rep. I'm the regional rep for Lynn, Benton, Lane counties. And so I'm here to provide technical assistance to your staff, to review your plan amendments, let you know if maybe there's something lacking in your findings, or there's a gap, or whatever, or congratulate you, you do good work. Any questions about the state? Yeah.
What's the biggest enforcement challenge that you folks face? Because I know there are municipalities that don't look on LTDC with great amount of favor.
Yeah. Measure 37, does that ring a bell?
Somewhat.
Raise your hand if you're familiar with Measure 37. Okay, so most of you or some of you. So I guess it was probably about 10 years ago. We get pushback when cities, probably more so counties, are required to say no to certain developments. And oftentimes it's residential development outside of the road boundary. I think that's probably our largest challenge, and yet I think we have the most at stake to ensure that we don't allow incompatible development, or basically residential development, to occur where it shouldn't. And I'll say shouldn't in sort of air quotes, according to Oregon statewide planning rules. The majority of housing needs to occur in urban growth boundaries. That's how we ensure that we can afford MX and we can have density around our nodes to support our small businesses. And so I think that's one area where we really, and we're certainly not perfect in how we develop plans and programs and how we implement them. But I think it's our protection of farm, and probably even more than farm, forest land. where I think we catch some hot water.
Thank you.
Sure. So I talked a little bit about the state and sort of our role. So cities and counties, this only works if we're in this together and we work in collaboration with one another. So I mentioned the comprehensive plan that each city and county in Oregon have to adopt in compliance with the renewed 15 statewide planning goals. Your comprehensive plan will address local visions and needs. I know you've gone through some visioning processes, and you probably done some design charrettes, and you've done a number of things to engage your citizenry on a number of different levels. Now in social media, we're seeing that we can be more effective in reaching out to folks that maybe 10 years ago we couldn't, and so it's nice to have young, fresh planners and officials coming in. It's cool that you've got you all seem pretty new to the Planning Commission. Do you have term limits?
Two terms.
2 years, yeah. There's many Planning Commissions that I worked with, and it was fine on the North Coast for some reason. Folks will have been on the commission for 10, 20, 30 years even. I had one fellow who served Fort Stevens, World War II, never left Clatsop County, and was on the Planning Commission since the inception of our comp plan. So with that comes a lot of great historical knowledge and institutional knowledge, but sometimes adapting to change can be difficult. I can just tell by knowing Springfield like I do after being here for a year, looking through the evolution of your plans, that you all, well, I like that you stick to your guns, that the way Glenwood is the best example for me, where I can see that there probably were times when it would have been easier to say, no, let's not do the roundabouts, or let's go ahead and allow certain development to encroach into these areas, because who knows if we'll see that development. Well, now what you've been able to accomplish in that area, I think, is remarkable, and speaks to how you address your local vision and needs, and you build into your plans and your codes the right sets of standards to make sure that as development, redevelopment occurs, that it's happening in a way that your citizens would expect or like. So it's your job to make land use decisions. Good luck with that. And to enforce your codes and ordinances, and then to provide assistance to the public. I think it's pretty funny, living here in Springfield, I have a couple, and I don't want to point fingers, but there's a couple roosters in my neighborhood, so of course, I had to look up your code. So Springfield's, or our code, Springfield allows roosters up to 6 months in age. I'm not sure who came up with that standard, but I have grown to like my neighboring roosters, so I know they're over 6 months, but you know, those kind of challenges, you ask what challenges the state, my experience, it's the code, it's those vagaries or inconsistencies in your development code that then can't really be abated, or your code enforcement process is difficult to administer. That was always sort of one of my biggest challenges for you all. There's not much I can do to help with the code enforcement stuff, but what I can do is try to lighten the load for you on some of the long-range plans, and to give you a hand in getting that work done so that you can dedicate staff time to what really is an important livability issue, being able to enforce your codes. This slide just kind of shows the relationship of the statutes and the administrative rules, and how they help to inform the comprehensive plan and the decision-making that promulgates under your comp plan and your development code. So talk a little bit about your comprehensive plan, because this is a centerpiece of your work. Whether it's a conditional use permit that requires compatibility with the comp plan or applicable policies, or it's a zone change, or you're working on your Main Street plan or what have you. The comp plan is really where the rubber hits the road, especially in Oregon. You know, these are compulsory. These are not voluntary, optional documents like they are in many other states. These come with them, the force of law behind them. And what we always look for in comprehensive plans are the enforceable policies. You know, you'll have certain policies that are aspirational, but you'll also have other policies that are enforceable. And those are the ones where you'll see them sort of mimicked or I guess more appropriately said, implemented in your development code. The last bullet point just talks about infrastructure, natural resources, economic development, transportation, all the elements of your comprehensive plan typically are based upon the statewide planning goals. Does your comprehensive plan, is chapter one, citizen involvement, and does it kind of go in the same order as the...
Well, we don't have a full comprehensive plan yet, first of all. We have some elements of our local comprehensive plan, and then otherwise we rely on the metro.
That's right, that's right.
But the chapters and the metro plan don't line up to the goals.
That's right, I forgot to add that. So some communities have decided to sort of take their comprehensive plan and sort of lined it up against the 15 statewide planning goals. So chapter 15 in the comp plan would be the Willamette Greenway, just like statewide planning goal 15. You might be a little more complicated than to be able to do that. But it doesn't really matter as long as you can find the stuff that you're looking for and it's organized in a way that kind of makes sense to you. I mean, one of the real challenges that I found is whether I was managing staff or I was working on an application was not knowing a certain policy existed or finding an economic development policy buried in the transportation element or finding, you know, a natural resource policy buried in the economic element or what have you. So long story short, rely on your staff, get to know your comp plan, your metro plan, get guidance from your staff on you know, what the most important, what the most germane documents are, planning documents are. Because we have a very sophisticated pool of applicants in this area. I knew coming into the valley that it was going to sort of be a step up from the coast in a way where there's more attorneys here, there's more people here, I think there's just more at stake here. And so when these applications come in, it's sometimes, because they're oftentimes very complex, difficult to know, well, what part of the comp plan, you know, use your staff. I'm always available to assist. When I do my day-to-day work, I like to spend time reading the Corvallis Urbanization Study or the Metro Plan or just kind of getting to know, you know, Philomath's got a big development going on, it's caused a lot of controversy, and so I think my heart is with local government. So I will, just like I'm suggesting to you all that you get to know your comp plan, I'll do the same thing. The factual base in a comp plan is important, provides the natural, social, and economic information that oftentimes forms the background report for your comprehensive plan. Since you've gone through several iterations of your comp plan, your metro plan, your discrete comp plan when complete, you know, all the previous versions will effectively form your background element to provide that important sort of intent or understanding of context, you know, how did you get here, kind of questions that come up at times, and so all of those historical documents are really important. The goals and policies, we've talked a little bit about the goals and policies in the comprehensive plan and how they form to guide the implementing measures of your development code. And then the maps. So you will have several maps in the comp plan. The most important one is your plan designation map. That will show you generally where you can expect housing to occur in the future, where you can expect your commercial, your industrial, your recreation lands, your institutional lands to be developed. Any questions about your comprehensive plan? And I know we'll have time. I'll make sure to wrap this up by quarter till we'll have time to chat. So the development code provides specific regulations that implement your plan policies. Things you're familiar with, setbacks and density and building height and those kinds of things are contained in your development code. It also provides the criteria for land use decision making and provides the procedures for partitioning, subdividing, zone changes, things of that nature. So I'll talk a little bit about the types of decisions that you all make. Basically, you'll make two types of decisions. You'll make a legislative decision or a quasi-judicial decision. We'll talk a little bit about legislative first. So a legislative decision is one that impacts a large geographic area, will have numerous property owners, would be a plan to update your wetland development standards, or it could be the urban growth boundary decision would be a legislative decision if you're looking at the city as a whole. Has to be adopted by the city council, the governing body, so you all would hold a hearing and then forward a recommendation to the council. And the council, they could remand the matter back to you all, or they would make a decision based upon your record, your recommendation. And that's how you typically would see at least two public hearings for legislative land use. The other decision type is quasi-judicial. And just like it sounds, you're kind of like a judge at that point. So I have many slides that we're going to talk about fairness and ex parte contact. You probably heard, come across that in your dealings, even if you're a brand new planning commissioner. You know, you probably hear some of these terms thrown around, and we'll talk a little bit about them. They can be confusing and sometimes intimidating, but they're really not. So a quasi-judicial decision is one that's site-specific. It would involve one property, maybe a couple properties, but a small, discrete area that can be readily defined, and the application process requires a response. State law, city ordinances, when somebody makes application for a quasi-judicial land use decision, could be a conditional use permit to do a home occupation or something like that. The local government, city of Springfield, has to respond. Legislative matters, you don't have to take action. City council can decide, we're not really interested in updating our chicken ordinance, it's just fine. Need like 6 months old. Quasi-judicial, different matter. You've got 120 days. You really are under the gun. Staff receives an application. They determine if it's complete. If it's not, they work with the applicant to get it to a complete stage. Once it's complete, 120 days to exhaust all local appeals, which means if it's a planning commission decision, appeals would go to council, hearings officer. No hearings officer. So,
yeah, we only have hearings officer for outside city limits for the unincorporated area within the UTB.
Oh, interesting. So do you have a different pathway for those properties? Okay.
And that takes the place of the planning commission as well.
All right. Interesting. Okay. You'll have to share with me why you do it that way.
Yeah.
Because I'm.
I just know we do. I think
it's just for the IGA with the county.
Okay. Yeah, because technically it's unincorporated, so an appeal would go to the Lane County Board of Commissioners. Because I think I'm in one of the neighborhoods where we're incorporated, but I think everything around us is unincorporated.
So it would have gone there, but I think the IGA from way back when says that they go to through a hearing official.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm amazed at how much unincorporated property there lies in Eugene's UGB, your UGB, Corvallis. It really makes things complicated, or complicates things. Okay, so we talked a little bit about who makes the decision. Quasi-judicial land use decisions require that there is an opportunity for hearing. Ministerial actions are something that would lead to a civil building permit. So if somebody wants to build a house on a lot that's zoned for residential, and the setbacks and the building height require no discretion. Should be discretion. When land is sloped, I call into question whether or not we're using discretion to really make a determination on building height when we're not requiring surveyors. But effectively, ministerial actions involve no discretion making, so they're done at the staff level. And there's no hearing. and no appeal opportunity.
Questions?
Okay. Talk a little bit about notice requirements. Do you do the legwork for applicants on notices, or do you require the applicants to come in with their set of mailing labels? You do it. So noticing requirements actually are really important. We just appealed a Linn County decision because they did not do proper notice. And it's not that we didn't like the decision, it's just that we couldn't allow precedent that something could move forward when there was pretty significant flaws in noticing. A Measure 56 notice that's in quotes there has to do with change in state law, I don't know, 10 or so years ago, that if we're going to, if the state or a city or county is going to change a zone that would affect permissible uses on property, then that requires an additional notice or a special notice that announces across the top or in some way that property value may be affected by the proposed change. I think when the notice requirements became more difficult as a function of Measure 56, my opinion, local governments kind of stopped doing important zone change and legislative work out of fear for having to send these notices out. But I think we have figured this out. I think we have figured out a way to notice social media as part of this, to be more efficient in the manner in which we notify our neighbors and then respond to questions and concerns. That's a big deal. I mean, when you send out a notice to 50 property owners, you know, there's a good chance you're gonna get 10 or 15 of them asking you questions.
I think Springfield has actually gone beyond the requirements on giving notice, because in many cases, not just adjoining property owners, but all interested parties notified, which is beyond the normal requirements. I think Springfield has exceeded the requirements in many cases.
That would only be required for legislative action.
No, I realize that, but I mean, Springfield has expanded upon the requirements.
Gotcha.
In some cases.
And if you can pull it off, that's a good thing. If you've got the staff capacity, it's, I think, always a better practice to get people involved on the front end, right, than sort of getting
That there's nobody that said, well, we didn't hear about it.
Yep, and that's a great point about, you know, local governments can go beyond the minimum state law.
This might be a Sandy question. I think it is a Sandy question. The last Measure 56 notice was sent out with the TSP code updates, and it kind of like acted as an invitation or segue to an open house that definitely made the next Planning Commission hearing look a little alleviated from public comment. Is that something that's like pretty normal to happen, is to pair with the open house?
Mm-hmm. I mean, like as Patrick was saying, you can do your required notice along with your Measure 56 notice if it's a quasi-judicial amendment. In this case, it was a legislative decision, and so we actually sent property notice to all the owners in the city. And because, as he said, it generates a lot of questions and comments, and even with that open house, our staff was very busy responding to people calling in. But having a place and a time where they can go to get more information, and including that in the notice goes a long way to reducing their fear. You know, they know, okay, immediately I can go get more information, and also just gives us a place to, you know, here we can come and talk to you in addition to all the phone calls and drop-ins that we get.
Okay. I'll just kind of go over the procedures for a quasi-judicial public hearing. Your chair would open the hearing, have an explanation of the proceedings, announce the sort of raise it or waive it statement. So that's a really important legal point. I'm not an attorney. I play one on the weekends. If an interested party, including us, don't raise an issue, then you waive your right to appeal based on that issue. Super important. If somebody is providing verbal testimony and you know they're wanting to or they're trying to lay the groundwork for an appeal, oftentimes you'll see that come in writing, more than just the verbal, but specifically, here's the criteria that have not been met, here's why, and it's your job to figure out what the most defensible decision is and move forward with it. The announcement of the criteria is important, so folks know what rules apply. And then there's a process of declaring ex parte contact bias, conflicts of interest, and then there's a staff report. So the order typically for quasi-judicial hearing would be once the hearing is open and you open the floor for testimony, you'll hear from the applicant, then other proponents, then opponents. Sometimes you can ask for those that are in neutral or have not had an opportunity to speak, and then the applicants provide an opportunity for rebuttal. There's always a chance, and state law accommodates requests for continuances and allows for the record to be left open upon request 7 days, or the 7-7-7 rule that I think you can apply, you can ask for, and you are obligated to provide for any interested party, leave the record open for 7 days, 7 additional days to provide testimony, and then the final seven days, I believe, are for the applicant to provide the final rebuttal. But that can draw things out a little bit. I mentioned about 10 minutes ago that local governments are really under the gun on quasi-judicial applications. 120 days to get the decision made, including exhausting all appeals. So if you figure an appeal to the city council is going to take 30 to 45 days, now you've got about 60 to 90 days to get the decision made. Well, staff needs some time to put their staff report together. You hold a hearing, you didn't quite get the information you're looking for, you continue the hearing, now you're 2 months, 60 days into 120 days, and then folks can ask for continuances. It gets a little tight at the end. I don't know if you've had a problem with the writ of mandamus issue. Good for you. Many cities and counties have run into a boatload of trouble by not meeting this 120 or counties 150 day rule. But it's just kind of important. I mean, you can't always do it. Just to be efficient, to make sure that folks are sticking to the criteria. And sometimes, I'm sure you've done it, you have to impose a 3 or 5 minute time limit on folks. And it's just a manner in which, as judges, as a quasi-judicial board, you're just trying to get through this work, because almost always there's something else in the queue. After the chair would close the hearing, then you all would deliberate and make a motion, and if seconded, then it's discussed, and you make your vote. And then after you voted, then either staff or sometimes the applicant will be directed to provide the written findings. On the legislative process, legislative processes, I think, are more fun hearings because you want everybody to participate. You're not just looking at a single issue on a single piece of property, but you're looking at something that's policy affecting the entire city. And you don't have to be concerned with ex parte contacts and bias. You can bring your opinions to the table and share them. And we'll talk a little bit more about ex parte contact and bias next, after we talk about findings. All right, I'm going to speed up. So findings of fact are really important. They're the relevant facts upon which a decision is based. The purpose of findings is to provide, to aid in careful consideration of the criteria by the reviewing body, to establish the evidence upon which the reviewing body relied upon in making its decision, and explains how the conclusions are supported by the evidence. Our Land Use Board of Appeals hates receiving appeals based on insufficient findings. They will just send them right back to you, say, no, you didn't make findings against the applicable criteria, try again. And that's, I don't know what the percentage is, but a large amount of the appeals that end up going up to the state Board of Appeals, which costs a lot of money and a lot of time. Your staff's got to produce a record. It gains you very little when your findings are insufficient. So it's really important work and something that, if you have an opportunity to go to planning commission trainings, conferences, it's always great to understand what a good finding looks like and the importance of the findings. Couple of tips, stick to the criteria, address them separately. Sometimes you can kind of assemble several criteria that are similar, but really it's better, it's always the best practice to address each criterion separately, and stick to the facts on what led to the conclusion. And if there is conflicting information, if you've got dueling scientists, you know, explain that in your findings. We've got conflicting evidence, but we're going with this because of X, Y, and Z. If you're going to impose a condition of approval, it's really important that you link that or articulate the link to the impact, ensuring that it's advancing a legitimate public good or public interest. That ties back to your comprehensive plan. If it's consistent with your plan, or if you're imposing a condition of approval, that's ensuring that that development proposal is going to meet your plan. That's an important link or nexus to provide in your findings. Here's some kind of common problems with findings. Generalizations are a typical problem. If you fail to show the causal relationship between the facts and your conclusions.
Can you give an example of the second bullet point?
Deferring a necessary finding to a condition of approval. If an application on its face, on review, you're not able to determine that a hillside development plan is going to meet your slope requirement. And as a condition of approval, you say, well, just we'll require an engineer to go out there and make sure they get it done. Something like that.
Great, thanks.
Was that an acceptable answer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is an interesting question because often you're saying in your conclusion that with this condition of approval, they will meet the criteria. And so you could say that, like you're saying, the setback is 5 feet. I'm going to use a really simple one. The site plan is showing at 4 feet from the property line. You could say, well, the condition of approval will require a revised site plan showing that the setback is now 5 feet, and then therefore you're meeting the 5 foot setback criteria. So that's a clear one that you can condition in that way. But if you're going to say, how are you going to meet that condition? Well, and the neighbors can't respond to how they're going to meet it because it's not been made clear because the engineer hasn't gone out to do the study, then they can't comment. And then.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I was trying to give an example where there'd be all kinds of discretion and questions by neighbors or interested parties. They got to the 19.9% slope by doing these huge cuts and fills. That was never part of the original proposal, but now they're going to go up and shave this hillside. So I was trying to give like a conditional approval that, you know, is kind of murky.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I know in some instances we have situations where there's simply not enough time between when we look at it and when city council looks at it. So a conditional approval might be attached that we're expecting once the city council will take a look at it and pass it, if they will, that condition of approval will be met at that point. I don't know, Sandy, if I'm right on that. I feel like I see that somewhat regularly.
I guess I haven't seen that situation, but that doesn't mean it hasn't occurred.
I know an example.
Yeah.
The cell tower up on Pioneer Parkway that they did not have an acceptable easement to start out with, but they were seeking an easement through two separate methods. And so I think that we approved it, given that they would.
Before city council.
No, it was our decision.
Yeah, so I think maybe what you're thinking of, would it,
It's a condition on your recommendation to council. What you're thinking about is when you would make a recommend. So that's not a condition of approval. A condition of approval is like there's a permit application and not a legislative land use decision.
I see.
Typically.
Yeah.
So you might, the gray area is like a zoning, zoning map amendment. You sometimes have conditions of approval on those, and then those if they're coupled with a plan, metro plan amendment, do go to city council.
Okay.
So, but what I think you're thinking about is we are recommending that the council approve this package, but we want to see you address this issue more specifically, and then the city council weighs in. For example, with ADUs, we're going to recommend for the code, you know, that you approve the code, but we want to see some changes on the parking, the on-street parking. So we're going to recommend approval with a condition that the city council look at this more. And that's not what he means by condition.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I mean, at times you do have to move things forward, and with that can come recommendations that you know, you'd rather resolve it at the planning commission stage, but the clock's ticking, so you've got to do something, typically working with your legal counsel to okay, well, we're going to go ahead and let the council, you know, hammer that out or get it done, and that's just a manner in which we work. Okay, now the fun stuff. So ex parte contacts, you know, it's a contact outside of the official record. It only applies to quasi-judicial decisions, so there's no ex parte contacts on legislative matters. And our advice is typically declare it. If Fred is the applicant or the neighbor and he catches you at Safeway, oh yeah, you know, I can't, you know, try to let folks know that appreciate your concern, but yeah, save that. That's great information. Let's save that, you know, for the hearing, or put it in writing. You should mention that at the outset of the hearing. The chair will ask if there's been an ex parte contacts. Yeah, you know, bumped into Fred at the shopping market. You know, he mentioned to me that he had some interest in this matter. I asked him to go ahead, you know, and save that so everybody could hear it. Site visits are ex parte contacts. Do you do site visits with your planning commission, or do you advise them to? Because every city is different this way. Some attorneys like the planning commissioners to go out, others don't. How do you guys work with that?
Well, I think typically we've deferred it to the planning commissioners to make their own individual judgments. I tend to caution against ex parte contacts just because it can be hard to disclose everything that you learned onto the record, and it leaves that area. But I think you're the best judges of your own, like your ethics are your ethics. So. We've had site visits. It's hard when you're in a small, I mean, we're not that big of a community,
yeah.
So it's hard to avoid, and certainly I'm never gonna tell you can't drive home on your normal route. There's an application, you know, the cell tower on Pioneer Parkway.
Yeah.
I'm sure many of you drove past that and observed it, you know. And I think that there was actually that discussion, like, I've seen the site, I know where it is, so those were disclosed.
Yeah.
It's just hard to avoid site visits sometimes inadvertently.
I think that's the best approach.
We've had decisions on parklands too, so obviously, how do you keep people out of the park to avoid the contact with the property?
You bet. Yeah, I mean, use your best judgment. The worst thing to do would be to go out on site and have the applicant on site or a neighbor, at least they're lobbying you or something. That's definitely a situation you want to avoid and run.
Drive-bys tend to avoid that more, right. like getting out and walking around.
Yes, your windows up. Staff is not an ex parte contact. You always can ask questions of staff. And the last bullet doesn't necessarily disqualification. Typically it wouldn't. You just disclose that you know, I went on the site and here's what I saw, and or I spoke to Fred and here's what he said. Conflicts of interest, so there's actual conflicts of interest where you or a family member would receive a monetary advantage or disadvantage as a result of the decision. If you have a direct conflict of interest, I mean, I'll defer your counsel, but you should, in my opinion, should recuse yourself. And sometimes it's not even enough to sit in the audience. Sometimes you should just sit out in the lobby until that particular land use matter is concluded. I mean, if it's like your property or your significant other's property or your direct neighbor, and you want to testify, you definitely want to try to separate yourself from the quasi-judicial board as best you can. But typically, we see more potential conflicts of interest. So this changes the effect would be monetary to it could have a monetary effect. Unless, and it gives some outs here, so if you're in a particular business or industry and you're required as part of that profession to hold a particular office or position, there are other potential conflicts of interest that will arise. I probably don't have a lot to say about this because it really is a case-by-case basis. My best advice to you is consult with staff and or your legal counsel if you ever have questions about whether or not you have a potential conflict of interest and what you should do with that. What it oftentimes, I think, comes down to is, are you able to judge this proposal putting aside any interest that you may have in the property or decision? Can you be biased? Can you look at this objectively? And if you can, then I think typically you can sit. I have seen chairs removed by the commissioners. That was very fun LNG here. Again, more about the potential conflicts of interest, you know, announcing, always just disclosing things is always the best practice. Even if you're not sure, disclose it. And then that's the advice there on if you have an actual conflict of interest. Almost done here. This is the second to last slide, actually. Bias, of course, if you prejudge something, you come in, you're predisposed. If you truly are incapable of setting aside your bias or opinion, then you need to recuse yourself. But we all have opinions, and I don't doubt that everybody in this room has professional acumen where, in most cases, you because we're all here for Springfield, right? We're all here giving our time because we want Springfield to be the coolest place on the planet, a great place to live, and so we oftentimes can set aside our opinions if it's not a direct or actual conflict of interest or if it's a bias issue, and oftentimes you can still participate. Those are the pictures that I took the other day of our great city, and there's 3 minutes for questions. Thank you for giving me this time. I appreciate it.
Seeing no questions, I guess we can probably. Thank you very much. It was a great presentation. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.